We're going to get into our study tonight, picking up again on our with our current theme of biblical backgrounds, kind of talking about what we're going through. Also interested in the, let me pull this up here real quick, as we are looking forward to, for folks that are going on the Israel trip with us here with Dr. Lawfer and myself at the end of the year, we're looking forward to seeing different places that we might encounter on our trip in the region of Israel, what's contemporary Israel today, as we'll be going with that, and see if I can find this, probably because I c.org/Israel trip. Oh, you know what I need to do? Something else. Nevertheless, let me get this. We'll get this all squared away here. Let me open us in prayer, and then we'll just get underway. So, Father, thank you for this evening. Thank you that we have time where we can again gather in your name and in your sight, that we're able to continue to enjoy your presence, and we're able to continue to celebrate those things that you're doing in our midst. Thank you for our church. Thank you for those who are part, and thank you for those who are assembling and gathering tonight, whether it's here or in these other different places, that we're able to continue to enjoy the fellowship and community of your Spirit. Father, we would just ask that you would be with this time, that you would just continue to bless us, and you would continue to allow your Spirit to be present as we engage in these discussions about the backgrounds behind your scriptures and behind the biblical revelation that we're able to get through so many different people, but also understanding the context in which they arose. We would ask that you would just be with this time in your precious name. Amen. So we're going to pick up tonight. We've got handouts in the back if you didn't get one just yet. We are looking forward to walking through the rise of Greece and Rome. We're going to talk about the history of the rise of Greece and Rome and the different things that are related to that. This is really, as we're kind of going to get into, this is a critical portion of the history of Israel, and it's a critical portion of what would ultimately form the basis for the New Testament. So much of the biblical account that we've talked about this in this period of time where we've been talking about biblical backgrounds, so much of what we encounter in Scripture exists in light of the context in which it arose. Just like we talked a couple weeks ago about how the Neo-Assyrian and the Neo-Babylonian empires arose and they gave way, or they gave a platform in so many ways for different prophets to develop and to speak. In that same way, much of the New Testament is the context that it is. It's the world that it is because of the context out of which it arose, because of the conversations out of which it arose, out of the communities out of which it arose, and the cultures in which it arose. And through all of that, we come to the biblical narrative with some understanding of what's going on. It helps us better see when a gospel writer speaks about a certain thing, or the book of Acts talks about the way that people went. Well, there's some good basis for that. There's some good realities behind that, and you're going to see some of this. And what I did for the, kind of the background for our conversation for up behind me is I put up a picture of a very well-preserved form of what is called the Romans Road and or the Appian Way, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as we get into all of this tonight because it is important for us to see what was going on. This was the superhighway of their day and age, particularly in this period as it would arise. This was the conduits and the many different ways in which Rome really developed as a superpower, developed as an empire, and was able to push itself out through the various innovations, through the various things that they had that they were doing. And as we find this, and particularly as we find this, this picture that I've been able to find, you see an example of what the Roman road would have looked like, the Appian Way, if you will, because it would have gone through a lot of different cities. Now, you can go to Rome today, and if you're going, you travel around Rome, and you see what's going on with everything, one of the things that you'll run into is you'll run into this kind of an example, or at least a display, of what the road looked like, and you can see a lot of the different features of it. It just kind of goes and it snakes along. You got your different pines of Rome that are here on the sides and so forth. But then you have what is ultimately a lot like a cobblestone street that we have today. And though it probably looked very similar to this, The Appian Way, the Romans Road, was that kind of a thing that provided Rome a way to establish itself as a commercial leader, as a financial or at least an economic giant in its day and age. And it's one of the things that becomes really significant in the New Testament, particularly because during that time, during the early period of Christianity, they were no longer known as Christians, or they weren't known as Christians yet, we should say. They were primarily, this is what they preferred for the first half of the first generation of Christians, to be known as followers of the way. There's a guy that has written a book called Evangelism in the Early Church. And in Green's book on Evangelism in the Early Church, he talks about how Christ comes to be at the precise moment in the world where the infrastructure, where the cultures, where the alignment of all the different bits and pieces all came together in a way that would allow the gospel to flourish and to expand at very high rates. Wouldn't have happened before, wouldn't have happened at a significant level any time before, but Jesus comes, it seems, at the right time to come to his people and to come with that. So we're talking a little bit about that tonight, and we're going to be talking, like I mentioned, about the about the old and this time between the Old and New Testament periods and what is out there with them. And this is the intertestamental period that we're going to be covering a bit tonight. So where we've been talking about with really the First Testament or the Old Testament, which occupies a substantial amount of Scripture, that the backgrounds of that have all been coming these successive weeks that we've been having, kind of finding our context from Genesis all the way to Malachi. Now we find ourselves on that blank page that so many physical copies of the Scriptures have, that intertestamental period, a time of about 400 years, where it was the time between the Old Testament and the New Testament. It doesn't mean that there wasn't stuff going on. There were no, we should say, inspired writings or inspired revelation that comes out during that time period. But there's a lot that happens during that time period, all of it which sets up so much of what happens in the New Testament period, all of which sets up, excuse me, the context for the New Testament, and particularly the life and ministry of Jesus Christ, which is what Frank will be talking about next week, but also what happens thereafter Christ's ministry on earth with his followers. This is the intertestamental period. Now, sometimes you'll run into, if you grew up or you're familiar with the Catholic Church, there are a set of books that they have as a part of their New Testament, or not the New Testament, part of their Bible, which is the Apocrypha, and some of the books of which arise during this time, or at least describe events during this time period, kind of an in-between kind of a period. During this time, two empires arose and took power in Palestine. Now, Palestine is the term that we're going to generally use for the for what is today modern-day Israel. It's where Gaza is, a little bit of what is Lebanon, a little bit of what is Syria, but we're really going to be talking about that region of Palestine, and that's what we're going to use primarily for that. The first of these is Greece. And Greece arises in 800 BC and runs till about 146 BC. And around that, around towards the end of Greece's time, the next major empire arises, which is Rome. And Rome arises in really about 150. And by arising here, I don't mean the founding of Rome. I don't mean the founding of Greece either. I mean when they kind of came on the stage as a major power. Rome was founded many, many generations before this point. But they really come onto the stage as a major power, and we're going to see one of the reasons why that is. but between the two of these, between Greece and Rome, we run into two significant powers that arise in this period of time for some very specific reasons. And they have some specific influences on what we do with today and how we do today and how we act and how we even understand things today. With what's going on. And one of the things I'll try to do a little bit tonight is I'm going to try to align a few of the data points or a few of the conversation points on what we're going to be talking about with Israel, with what's going on with that trip as well, just so we can keep in front of us. So a couple of things that I think is really interesting, I've kind of laid this out in the notes. The Greek Empire develops many lasting social innovations. The Greek Empire develops many lasting social innovations, and there are a lot of things that they pulled together that we still deal with today, things that we still are involved with today. One of the first things is the concept of city-states. The concept of city-states, also the republic rule that comes out from this time. This is a rule of the people. City-states occupied a lot of the ways that, at least in the founding of our country, that a lot of the colonial states may have been. They were autonomous. They didn't necessarily have a national federation that they were a part of, or a national network that they were a part of. They knew each other. They knew what was going on. Some of them would be at war with each other. They would have fleets. They would have different things. They'd go to war at different times. We hear about all these things that come up. But the city-states became very significant. I remember when I was in seminary, I took a class, Christianity, Politics, and Power, that began talking a little bit about these subjects. And one of the formative things for Western civilization was, and as we discussed, was the development of city-states. The development of that. Also this idea of the republic that comes up. The republic, something that permeates the nature of Greece, but then also works itself somewhat into Rome. And then we get kind of into the medieval period, and that goes away quite a bit because it's good to be the king. But in this time, you find a different way that governments work, or at least new experiments on how governments work. And so forth. Another major thing is what we would consider to be philosophy, though philosophy exists at different times and spaces outside of now, but there is some philosophy that develops here. Some of the great philosophers of the world come out of ancient Greece. Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, all the different ones that we might remember, a lot of other different conversation points that happen with that. But philosophy happens during this time, and people begin thinking, and they give way to being able to start thinking about things greater and broader than themselves. One of the reasons is because Greece provided a suitable infrastructure where people could spend a career or a lifetime contemplating deep questions, deep thoughts, that amid Athens or amid some of the major cities, that people had the space where they could do these things. They could think about the conversations. They could think about the meaning of deep thoughts and what it was. A philosophy arises. Also, early Western medical practices. Early Western medical practices begin to develop. And I say Western medical practices because we are aware that in the East, in China, what is today modern China and Japan and Korea, in the East, in the Orient, they had medical practices that were already in play and already in place that they were working with, things that they would use, that things in ways that they would be to help other people. Well, some of that comes about as well with Greece. That comes about with understanding how we're going to operate, how we're going to navigate as doctors or as medical practitioners. And it's not very sophisticated as we might think today, but there are some modern medical practices that happen. Also, mathematics, including geometry, come out of Greece in this time. And then one of the things that we get to see every, 4 years or 2 years at this point, depending upon what cycle we're on, we get to see the Olympics. And the Olympics that would be held competing between city-states, who would wear the crown of olives, olive leaves, who would wear those different things, those different ways of exampling and running out and doing the great things of the Olympics and athletic conversations. It was interesting, I found a conversation about 20 Greek inventions or innovations that we use even today. And it was a list that included things like the alarm clock, vending machines, one of the earliest computers, which isn't exactly what we might expect it to be, but it was a way of calculating a position of a ship, and it was in a box with about 30 different bronze gears all articulated a certain way, but also central heating, plumbing, showers, the automatic doors that would come around with using fluid hydraulics to open. But also urban planning, how you lay out a city, how you make sure the city has the appropriate places for plumbing, for different places for that, so that you don't have everybody just together where disease could spread, but rather that it was easy to clean. Lighthouses were invented as well, steam engines. We don't really use lighthouses as much anymore. But steam engines, the spiral staircase, clock towers, maps, odometers, water mills, Archimedes screw, which is a long kind of a conduit where you're able to take that and you're able to move water from one place to another, whether it's from a lower canal to a higher canal or as a bilge pump out of the base of a ship. Anchors, as we see them today, are developed in Greece in this time. But also the astrolabe, the catapult, and for so many of us, one of the most important things, which is cheesecake, is invented in this time as well. So one last point that I have there on the page, which is Hellenization, is also something that comes up in this time. And what happens, and this is really unique, and this is something that occurs with Greece, and it has happened before in other places. We see this in Scripture, in examples of how Israel becomes tied to other cultures, where other cultures kind of come in and water down the religion of Israel. But more so now, this happens in a secular culture or secular context. The Hellenization, which is the spread of Greek culture and ideology, arises here. Hellenization is kind of where when Greece went out into these different places, they would take their philosophies with them. They would take their ways of life. They would take their economic understandings. They'd take their political understandings. They'd take all these other things with them, and they would kind of go out in that place. And the people, the cultures, whether they were conquering them through military means or political means, they would kind of adopt some of what happens. They would adopt some of the Greek identity. This actually comes out in this time, and there's a significant pushback among the Jewish people, the Hellenists. And there's actually, you can see traces of this in the New Testament. One of the things that I think is so intriguing about the way that Jesus develops his disciples is he puts people in close proximity who shouldn't have anything to do with each other normally. One person that might have been considered a Hellenist was Matthew. He was a what? He was a tax collector. Yeah, so he was a Hellenist. He was helping the Romans at the time collect their taxes, and he was bringing in a foreign culture and corrupting his people. And there was, but yet right next to him was a guy named Simon the Zealot, or Simon Zelotes. And the Zealots were a fringe, radical fringe group of Jewish patriots, or for lack of a better term, that would go around, and they were well known for assassinating Hellenists. If you were a tax collector and you irritated the Zealots enough that they said that you watered down Judaism so much, they'd take their assassin's blade and put it between your ribs, or they'd try to poison your food. And what's so intriguing about this is Simon the Zealot, or Simon Zelotes, is occupying the same space as Matthew the tax collector, Matthew the Hellenist tax collector. And Jesus brings them together at the same table so that they can share the same space. It's quite amazing how that works and how Christ has the ability through faith in him to do that as well. But going on with this, crucial to development of Greece was the leadership of Alexander the Great, the son of Philip II of Macedon, who was, and this is Alexander, was king of Greece at the age of 20. And if you ever want to get depressed about life, look and see what Alexander the Great accomplished in his first 5 years in comparing to what you were doing between the ages of 20 and 25. And it always causes us, granted, he was the right guy in the right place at the right time, which always helps. But we know that, and if you're familiar with these stories, that Alexander goes and does some amazing things for the Empire of Greece. Greece grew directly because of Alexander the Great. And a couple of things that go on with that. One, we see that Alexander unified the independent city-states. These city-states had been at war for generations. They had been angry at each other. We know these stories. We know the stories of these amazing battles that took place. We've seen movies about these things. Well, after Philip II, his dad, conquers all the city-states, Alexander then goes about the task of unifying them, and he does it. He brings them together to be a concerted, to be a unified nation, or at least a unified identity. What's really intriguing is, and I'll touch on this here in a moment, when we were took our trip to Greece last March with a bunch of folks from UBC, one of the places that our tour guide took us, so we left out of Thessaloniki, and we drove down the road, and we went to Kalambaka, We were on the way to Kalambaka, I should say. But in the middle, we stopped at a place called Veria, or what is known in the New Testament as Berea. And we went and we went up the stairs to this place, and there's a schoolhouse off to the side with a soccer field. And there's this monument to the man named Paul, the apostle, because there's a place in Acts where it talks about how Paul knew the Bereans, people who search the scriptures every day. And we spent some time there. There's not much to see there, but we spent some time there, and then we carried on, and we went to a different, for lunch, we went by another town not too far away called Vergina. And in Vergina, there is a little tell that was there, a little mound of dirt, if you not little, but it was a pretty big mound of dirt. It looked like a hill. And our bus pulled in and dropped us off. We had no idea what we were getting into. And what happened is our tour guide, a wonderful lady named Andy, who was very well, she was as close to a lay scholar as you can find, on ancient Greek history, had taken us to the burial tomb of Philip II of Macedon. And we were able to walk into this. And it's really simple because you go and you pay for your tickets. There's a guy there at the booth and you walk right in to a place where a man was buried at the end of his life that was over 2,000 years ago. And you walk in, obviously they've excavated the whole thing and they've got it all laid out very, very well. And you run into things and you run into this man's crypt, a man who, and I'll give you these two pictures real quick, a man who helped bring about the conquering of the known world by his son. Philip II of Macedon was a significant leader. And what's amazing about it is you can walk through the man's tomb that's over 2,000 years old. And as you can see on the right of the screen behind me is sort of a darker image because everything's very low dark. It's very low light because, I mean, this stuff's been in the ground forever. And what it is this is what Philip II was buried in. This is his armor and his sword and his shield that he was buried with. Only a few, maybe 150 or 200 yards away down in his tomb. This is what he was buried with. And obviously we have a bust of him that's been preserved from that time period. It's very similar to busts that you'll see. But you're able to walk around and you find all the things that they found. What's really intriguing about the story is the archaeologist who ultimately found Philip II's tomb was a man. He'd been in his career and he had had a dream at one point where it was for Philip II of Macedon came to him in his dream and said, "You will find my tomb before the end of your career." And he went on about trying to do that, and guess what? He walked into the right tomb at the right time, and he found Philip II's tomb. And nobody knew it had been there. It had been covered up forever. And he was able to find it. You can go there today. It's pretty amazing stuff. And again, something that's over 2,000 years old. But Alexander would unify the independent city-states. And then he would go on to, within a few years of becoming king of Greece, begin to wage war against Persia and King Darius III in 334 B.C. In 334 B.C., they suspected he took an army of about 40,000 people, and he took them across what is known as essentially what is larger Persia, but took him all the way from what is, and this is, I got a picture up here. This is a little bit different than the one that's in the Atlas. I prefer this one because it gives you a little bit more distinct lines. That's a little bit easier to see, I think, on the screen. But imagine that you're Alexander the Great, and you've grown up right here, and you take your army all the way to India here. And then because you're not done, you're also taken to Egypt here. And you conquer all of this space within a few short years with an army of about 40,000 people. Now, he did gain some followers. But you see what he's able to do with that. It's stunning. It's amazing. He moved the army farther, faster than anyone in history, and that includes General Patton. And the thing is that he did is he conquered lands and countries and empires and peoples that we can't even begin to imagine today. And he took them all the way to the Indus River, to the border of India. And he's able to accomplish this. He takes out the Persian Empire, which we had talked about a couple weeks ago, and which we talked about last week as well. He waged war against Persia and King Darius. Alexander conquered most of the known world by 330. Imagine that. He begins going to war in 334, and in 330 he had conquered almost all of that territory that you saw on that map. In 4 years he did that. He would die under suspicious circumstances in 323, though. And he died in Babylon. Now, the question is, how did he die? Well, there's a bunch of going theories on this. University of Maryland commissioned a study where they believe that he died because of typhoid. Well, that's the in vogue study right now. But sooner or later, somebody's going to come along and say he was poisoned. Or he was, another way, he was also assassinated by his people because he had been driving them so long, so hard, for so far that they were kind of restless at this point. He dies under suspicious circumstances. That's all we can really say about him. There is a lot of hope that people can find a clear determination. It's always more interesting if it's his people that killed him after he conquered so much. But the reality of history so often is it's probably something fairly mundane, like typhoid fever or something like that, that knocked him off. Nevertheless, but when it happened, his kingdom was divided to four generals that served with him, as there was no heir. Now, I've put heir in quotation marks because there were heirs. He had an unborn son that he had conceived prior to him getting sick, who was in utero at his death, who could have technically been his heir, but then he also had a brother who could have been his heir, who was the brother that came from a union of Philip II of Macedon and his wife. But the problem was is that his brother, Alexander's brother, was referred to in the literature of as a half-wit. And obviously, they didn't speak of people as helpfully as we can. They believe that he probably had a significant learning disability, or maybe he's on a spectrum or something, but he did not have the same abilities as his older brother. Those two were passed over. And what ended up happening is this entire kingdom of this region was then taken over and was divided up into four specific regions. You can actually see them in the map to a degree. The atlas does a really good job of dividing up the kingdoms in a helpful way. You can see a little bit of this. The different colors mean different things. This is the Ptolemaic kingdom, which is very important for our studies. This is the Seleucid kingdom, which is most of Persia and Babylon. Then you also had, I need to get my note here real quick. Then you had the Soter kingdom. The Soter kingdom is what is basically today modern day Greece, which is right up in here. And then you had the kingdom of Antigonus Monothelemus that came up as well during this time period, which is a little bit smaller, but it's basically Macedon up in here, up and above. So the kingdom got divided in four ways. The Seleucids obviously had the largest portion by far, and Seleucid the First ruled out of what is in modern day Iraq today. And that there were wars, ended up ultimately being conflicts, which isn't surprising, between these different rulers or these different lines that come out of them. But the critical one that we want to talk about, which we're going to get to here in a moment, is the rule of Ptolemy the First. But wrapping up a little bit of our conversation, this is a mosaic. It's a very famous mosaic. It's unsurprisingly and unoriginally called the Alexander Mosaic because it features Alexander the Great. It's very old. It's from about 100 BC, so it's fairly it's not contemporary, but it's closer than a lot of the other stuff that we have. It's part of a larger mosaic that depicts the battle between Darius III and Alexander the Great. But this is what the mosaic artist depicted as close as he could, Alexander the Great's sort of his likeness. And it's always good to see what these things look like there. As we continue to see, during this time, Alexander changed the political face of the Eastern Mediterranean region all the way to India. And we see that with these kinds of charts, with these kinds of maps, the things that go on there. Alexander expanded the Greek Empire beyond what anyone else was going to be able to do. He also expanded it so far that it wasn't able to be managed well from Athens. So that's one of the other reasons they had to distribute it to four specific generals. With everything that was going on there as well. But so critical to our study, which is what we're going to get into here, critical to our study is then this: the Palestinian region of and all of Egypt was transferred to Ptolemy I in 323 BC, and the region was governed by Egypt, actually you should say out of Egypt. Ptolemy basically found a place in Alexandria, and he was able to run out of that space there, and that's kind of how he governed things. During this time, the land of Palestine saw constant political upheaval from wars and transfers of power. There's constantly people coming and going. There's constantly wars, battles, things that happen, things that go on here and there. And across the intertestamental period, Palestine still exists as a land. You recognize it today. They haven't shifted that much in terms of what the geography looks like, but the political boundaries, they change all the time. And during this time, Palestine saw constant political upheaval. The Seleucids come down and try to take out Ptolemy's people. And that's kind of one of the things that happens a couple different ways. Then you have other factions that come and go in this way. But then one of the things that ends up happening, which is really significant, is after assisting Antiochus III in defeating Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, in about 200 BC, the Jews were given tax relief and allowed to practice the religion of their heritage, and were allowed to practice their religion. They were allowed to reinstitute sacrificial system for a time. They were allowed to be able to go to the temple that had been rebuilt by Zerubbabel and practice in there as well. And these are very important things because, it allowed the Jewish identity to be retained. And what ultimately ends up happening out of this is what we know as the Maccabean Revolt. And the Book of Maccabees in the Apocrypha is always fun reading, by the way. If you've ever seen the movie Braveheart and kind of remember the nature of the movie Braveheart, basically take that and put it into this period, and that's what you got. Because this is a group of oppressed people who then rise up against their rulers. There's a love story, kind of. And there's all kinds of stuff that go on. And they're really good because they know the terrain in which they've been raised. It's kind of one of those things that in Braveheart and with William Wallace, the story goes, when the British come up, one of the reasons that they were able to take out the British in one of the battles is because they knew the terrain, they knew the topography, they knew how to fight them. They chose the ground on which they would fight. So they were able to go and kind of marshal around them and keep them sequestered. But so along these lines, this is on the back of the page there, we get into this. Perhaps one of the most significant events of this time was the Maccabean Revolt, which we're talking about in 168 to 142 BC against Antiochus V. And this was, they were able to reestablish Jewish sacrificial systems, cleanse the temple, and this is where Hanukkah comes out of, the celebration of Hanukkah, which is a very important point with that. If you actually ever go to Rome, and I'll mention this real quick, if you ever go to Rome and you're walking through the Colosseum region, and you're also walking around the Colosseum, not region, sort of the Colosseum sector that's right there, you'll have a lot of these amazing ruins. You'll see Constantine's, a significant building from Constantine, all this other stuff. You'll run into Titus Arch, or the Arch of Titus. And Titus was the son of Vespasian, who ultimately went and destroyed, sacked Jerusalem and destroyed the temple in 70 AD. They built a monument to him, and inside, so you go up to the monument, which is the Arch of Titus, and you can walk through it even today. They have some big barriers up because people kept like being tourists, and it kind of got wore down on the sides. But up, and if you walk in and you look up off to the side, up in this kind of this region is this larger relief that I've pulled out here. And one of the things that's really intriguing about this, you can see some things. This is from when Titus conquered Jerusalem. And what he does is he takes, this is talking about the time that he takes out and he goes and he brings back to Rome, because this is in Rome. He brings back the pillaging and the many treasures that they were able to take out of the temple and out of Jerusalem. And one of the things that they take, that they've noticed, is this thing right here. And what is that? It's a menorah. Yeah. So again, going all the way back to the Maccabean period, the menorah comes out. And this was the grand menorah that would have been in the temple. Also would have been part of the Jewish sacrificial system for a long time. And it's interesting that it comes out, and it's one of those things that is seen as taking a people over. And it kind of talks about that as well. And again, during that time, if you ever want to have some really interesting reading and some reading that's free, you can read the books of Maccabees. They're available for free. If you can go to one of the Bible software places and you can read through them. A really interesting history. It all begins because during that time period, they came in and they desecrated the altar in the temple. And then in desecrating the altar in the temple, they murdered a priest. And in the midst of all of this, that causes, ultimately, it's the flashpoint that causes the rebellion and the revolt to rise up. It's very similar to when we saw the Arab Spring happen, not too many years ago. Does anybody remember what the flashpoint of the Arab Spring was? There was a street vendor in Morocco who had been basically attacked by some police who were trying to get some money out of him. He had a payment that was due to the police, one of those protection payments. And he couldn't afford it because he was a poor street vendor. And they had been beating him. They were going to tell him he was going to go to jail. So he went in the middle of the square, doused himself in gasoline, and lit himself on fire and self-immolated. And that caught, and it was the hook that started the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring ultimately would go all the way across northern Africa. It would disrupt Libya. It would completely pull all the leadership out of Libya. It caused massive upheavals in Egypt and throughout the region there as well. Again, one flashpoint. But what happens with that flashpoint is it's on top of a growing mound of tinder. And this is what happens with the Maccabean revolt. The one flashpoint was the desecration of the altar. And that becomes the thing that kind of tips the balance. What is interesting that happens after the Maccabean revolt is that the Jewish people, the Jewish state, becomes free. And from 143 to 63 B.C., so from 143 to 63 B.C., a period of about 80 years, an independent, free Jewish state existed in Palestine, led by the Hasmonean dynasty. And this was a time of great flourishing in Israel or in Palestine. And over these 80 years, they were able to establish and lead a free Jewish state, autonomous from any outside rule. This had been hundreds and hundreds of years in the making. And what's funny is, guess what would happen? After 63 BC, it wouldn't happen again until the establishment of a political state of Israel much later, after World War II. Imagine how long the breadth of that history is. We've talked about this. You've been hanging out with us. We've been talking about the free Israel people, the people that are of the people of God's, from Abraham's calling, from God's design, that are called into a land that they are given, a promised land that they are given, and they're able to self-rule until they kind of get around themselves. And then they go away because of the different oppressions, the different deportations, the different exiles. And then they come back and they're oppressed by different peoples, the Persians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. And then they get into the Greeks, and the Greeks come back and oppress them. The Egyptians are always in the midst of them. And then suddenly, finally, in 143 BC, they didn't know it was 143 BC, but in 143 BC, they create a free Jewish state. And for 80 years, they have a free Jewish state until ultimately they were taken over again by Pompey, which we'll talk about here in a moment. One of the things that's really intriguing about this time is that during this time the Septuagint was completed. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The Septuagint, I have up there this LXX. You'll see that in your if you're carrying a Bible around with you. You're ever looking through the notes, or if you have a good study Bible, or you're reading some stuff, and sometimes they'll have an abbreviation, LXX, or cross-reference or something. What that is, it's the Greek translation of the Hebrew. And the legend goes that, this is kind of the myth of it, we know that this is, well, we believe this isn't what happened, but as the myth goes, 70 Jewish scholars, now the LXX is Roman numerals for 70. So 70 Jewish scholars went into the 70 different rooms. They all took copies of the Old Testament with them, and they sat down and at one point over several days, they sat down and they all translated the Old Testament into Greek. And when they came out, they compared all of their translations, and they were perfect, and they were completely aligned. This isn't really what happened, but that's how the story went. And this was the Bible of Jesus' day. The LXX, the Septuagint, was the primary Bible of Jesus' day. Now, Jesus, probably when he's preaching, he's going to speak from an Aramaic, or he's going to speak from Hebrew, but the primary Bible of Paul's writings, the primary Bible of Matthew's writings, of any of the other New Testament, appears to have been the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, because this is their trade language, this is what they would have known. But it's very intriguing that it was completed during this period as well. What's probably true about it is that the Septuagint probably had multiple editions and kind of all came together, and it was loosely associated with, but it does seem to have been in final form by Jesus' day and age. Another map in here. This is the this is Palestine during the rule of the Ptolemies. Kind of gives you an idea of kind of the sectors that you get to in here. You have different, this is the region of Samaria right down here. Then obviously you have Judea. It goes right here. This is the region of Galilee. When we get to Israel, we'll be staying up in this region for the first couple nights. And then over here, you've got Jericho, which is right here. Then you have Jerusalem, which is right here. Obviously, the spiritual and administrative capital. And a couple other things. This is Phoenicia, which is, again, right on the coastline with Tyre and Sidon. Some interesting biblical names that work in there as well. So you see, this is kind of the region, the sectors under the Ptolemies. Not anything that we haven't seen before, kind of maps that we're familiar with. Moving along, though, around this time, though, with the disappearance, sort of the decline of the Greek Empire, the new empire arises, which is the Roman Empire. And the world had never seen an empire like the Roman Empire. The world had never seen the organization that the Romans brought. But they become and emerge. They emerge as a historic global power. It began in about 300 BC. Now that said, that's when we kind of say that the Roman Empire begins. But one of the things that we talk about is that Rome traditionally is understood to have been founded on April 21st, 753. And this is a real specific date. Again, we're talking about kind of mythos, kind of the myth that happens with this. The idea here was that Romulus and Remus, orphans who were raised by a she-wolf, founded Rome, but Romulus killed Remus in order to become king of Rome because they had a disagreement with the two of them. If you're ever walking around Rome or you ever see some stuff that looks kind of funny when it's referencing Rome, and you see a picture or a statue or something like this. This is a statue or a picture. This is actually a statue of Romulus and Remus and their she-wolf, for lack of a better term, mother. Obviously, they're taking milk from the she-wolf, and this is how they kind of grew up, according to the myth and the legend. So you'll see this occasionally throughout Rome. You'll see it on some different, maybe some money or something like that. It's the myth. It's that concept of how Rome emerges during this time period. So Romulus and Remus apparently founded it. We're not sure exactly how it happened. In this time, and this is one of the things that the Atlas kind of shows, what we know of today is Italy, which is kind of the boot, wasn't unified until hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, but it has a lot of different states, has a lot of different countries inside of all that, a lot of different regions, and Rome becomes one of them with that. The Via Appia, or the Appian Way, which is what, again, we have behind the picture, sort of behind our points here, the Roman road, was constructed in about 312 BC and linked all of Italy together. It became a very significant thing for Rome. Rome had a lot of innovations just like Greece did. One of the things that's really intriguing is the Roman arch. The Roman arch is a way to create doorways. And one of the strange things of history that happens that we don't have a lot of good explanation for, I believe it is the Aztecs. And if you go around and you find the Aztecs and you find their ancient ruins of the different ziggurats that they had, you will find in one of them a perfect Roman arch. It shouldn't be there. We're not sure why it's there, but it's there. And it's one of those things that we can't always explain in history. And there could be a lot of good reasons. One of the most obvious ones is that they figured it out, because, I mean, it's just architecture. But there's a couple other ways. Part of that is the keystoning that goes at the top, and then the different kind of the way that the rocks or the bricks or whatever work in with that. That's kind of an example of a Roman arch. Rome's emergence, again, kind of going on along this, after conquering Greece in 150 BC, Rome, that's about 150 BC, Rome takes over much of the northern Mediterranean region by about 100 BC. And if you'll see some of the maps that are in the Atlas, this is one of them. This is kind of what Roman expansion looks like by about 100 BC. You can see most of the region of the northern Mediterranean is under control, all the way from what is today modern-day Spain and Portugal, all the way up through what is now today, which is kind of southern France, what is now also Italy today, but then down into the different places, Greece in here, western Turkey. You kind of see how far Rome spread. That map, by the time of Jesus' day, ultimately also includes much of North Africa, all the way down into Egypt. Rome was an aggressive power, and they moved very quickly. Not as quickly as Alexander the Great, but still very quickly. Rome, led by Pompey, conquers Jerusalem in 63 BC. This is an important time period, because, again, Rome goes in and conquers that region, the region of Jerusalem, Palestine, and particularly Jerusalem, in this time. Around here is a very important date, if you're familiar with the Ides of March. March 14th is when Julius Caesar was murdered. And it's a really important time because a lot of Roman history goes up to that point and moves beyond that point. And much of what happens for the next, and particularly for Jesus' era, is a part of that because of what happens to Julius Caesar when he is assassinated and he is murdered on this day. This is kind of what goes on with Rome in that period. There's some really interesting personalities you've probably heard of in the past, Pompey being one of them. He conquers Syria in 64 BC and Palestine in 63 BC. Octavian, who is the great nephew of Julius Caesar, along with Mark Antony, he defeats his uncle's murderers at Philippi in 42 BC. And then also Mark Antony, who is a confidant of Julius Caesar in this time, controlled the Eastern Roman Empire with Cleopatra until 31 BC. And we all can remember some of these names, particularly if you're a Shakespeare fan. You'll be able to see a little bit of this. But all of this gives way to what happens to the people of Israel after Pompey conquers them, and we pick up on this. After Pompey's conquering, Herod the Great is confirmed by the Roman Senate as king of the Jews in 40 BC. Herod the Great is this fella. This is a remaining bust that we believe we have of Herod the Great. And Herod the Great led perhaps one of the greatest revivals of the what is today modern-day Israel, at that time Palestine region. And he does so because he's given a very large region to administrate, basically all of Israel and Syria, and that he ultimately leads it very well. And one of the reasons that he leads it well is because Herod embarks on a great campaign to build things. The Israel of Jesus' day is transformed from what it had been to what it ultimately becomes because of Herod. He goes and he modernizes the region. He installs plumbing to a degree. He installs gutters. He installs different parts to help make sure that Jerusalem flourishes. He installs different ways of sewage to be able to run. He puts in the aqueduct system to bring fresh water into the middle of Jerusalem, into different cities as well. And he was a great builder who modernizes the region, including Jerusalem, with Roman innovations. But he also does this. He rebuilds the temple. He rebuilds the temple. Now, we're already in the second temple period. So there's a first temple period, which is very significant for Israel. We've talked about that already. The second period temple begins when Zerubbabel goes and rebuilds the temple. And obviously this isn't a picture from the day. This is kind of a rendering. This is Zerubbabel's temple. It was probably reconstructed in about 515 BC. It was a shadow of the Solomonic temple. It just wasn't as fancy. They didn't have as much money. They didn't have the power. They didn't have the oomph. They didn't have what it took to really get the temple back up to where they wanted it to be. But they knew that they needed a temple in order to have a sacrificial system. It just was missing some stuff. It had a lot of stuff that wasn't always the best. It had a lot of stuff that wasn't always exactly what they wanted it to be. The Zerubbabel temple was functional. Herod comes in and he builds and rebuilds an amazing temple. He goes and through a lot of different systems, he builds what is ultimately this. He builds the Herodian temple. Now, you can go in a couple different places. You can see this. If you go to the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., I believe they have a scale map of Jerusalem from Jesus' day. This, I believe, is actually from Israel. This is a model of the Herodian temple. The Herodian temple was much more opulent. He went back through and he rebuilt the temple that had been in disrepair. And he adds gold features to it. He goes and he puts back the proper kind of cedars of Lebanon. And what's so intriguing about this is he paid so close attention. He scrutinized every detail. And he goes and he pays close attention to the Jewish laws on how they built the original temple, including taking priests of Jewish priests, training them to be stonesmiths, so that they are stonemasons, so they could go cut out the marble and install it without the sound of a hammer inside the temple, so to speak. The Herodian temple is ultimately what lasts until 70, when then that is destroyed and we've never seen the temple since. But the Herodian temple was an amazing temple. And in the second period temple, it becomes a very significant one for the Jewish people. It was interesting. I got into conversation with somebody, I get into the most interesting conversations, about why did Herod rebuild the temple? And there's a lot of different reasons for it. One of them could be that he wanted to levy more taxes, which is true. He probably wanted to levy more taxes. Another one was probably Jewish appeasement. He wanted to make sure that the Jews were kind of under control. But the other thing I really think it is, the other thing that he wanted to do is he wanted to show that he was great. I mean, what's greater than taking a people's religious identity and conforming it and funding it around your image? But I think the other thing for me is that a conquered people are a lot easier to rule when you allow them to have their religious identity and you allow them to have that kind of that identity secure, or at least practicable. I think Herod is a very shrewd ruler. It seems to me very clear that he is, and we run into that with it. But he also does some other things with that campaign of building and so forth. He was a great builder. But during this time, Palestine flourishes economically, and it becomes a major trade route. One of the reasons on the day of Pentecost there were so many different languages in Jerusalem on that time was because they were a major trade route. They had a major road going through them, and they became that significant place. But he also consolidated power in this time period and levied heavy taxes. And this is kind of how he would rule and how he would go with what he did. We will run into a couple of the places that are familiar with Herod. One of them being, we're going to be in Masada on one of the days, on day 8, we're gonna swing by Masada, and this is a picture of Masada. This is kind of an aerial shot of it. It looks kind of just like a normal rock kind of a deal, but it really is that place that Herod had uniquely built, and he had it built between 37 and 31. It's a hilltop fortress, and wanted to make a fortress for himself so he could go hide out. And it had large storehouses, it had cisterns, they were filled, honestly, the cisterns were filled with rainwater, which was an innovation of its time, but he also had palaces and barracks and armories. 75 years after his death, during the revolt of the Jews against the Romans that would ultimately lead to Titus coming in and sacking Jerusalem, a group of Jewish rebels took over this garrison and had to be cast out of it. And it's a rather significant part of the history of it. But then another thing that Herod builds, he builds this place, which is the Herodium. The Herodium, what he did, and this is really amazing, he goes and he takes what is basically, I don't know if it's a mountain, but he has his engineers come through and they cut off the top of the mountain. And they basically, you know, it would normally have come up like this. They go down a couple hundred feet and cut it off and then just excavate the whole thing. And then you can see kind of on the inside, here's a major entry point. And then what he has is sheer walls up the sides here. I mean, think about how smart this is. He has sheer walls on the sides. He has one point where you can go up and down. It's very hard to access. And then in here, you have a situation where you're seated down inside the mountaintop behind significant walls, the mountain itself being its greatest defensive system. And that's where, when he had a problem come up, he would take his family and he dropped his family off at the Herodium because he knew that there wouldn't be any problems. Put a garrison of guards with them, and that he went on about fighting a revolt and an uprising because he knew they would be safe there. This is the kind of thing that Herod does in building with Rome. And this ultimately all delivers us to the time and day where we get to the context of Jesus' era in which he is born. And we see that Greece had come and gone, and now Rome is on the scene. Rome is going through a significant upheavals of themselves. You have the different Caesars that are in place. You have the different lines that are going on. We're right in the middle of the Julian and Claudian dynasties of Rome. Augustus is, at this point, is still the emperor, still the Caesar of Rome. That's going on in this time period. He would give way to a couple others that would come about. And we'll talk in another couple weeks when we get back for our final session. One of the most interesting years in all of history is the year 69, because that's the year that Rome had four distinct emperors and ended up with Flavian Vespasian, who was one of my favorite characters in all of history. But we'll talk about that when we get there. But this is what we are left with. This is the context in which Jesus himself is born into. And by the end of this era, by the end of the intertestamental era, Rome was the dominant power in Palestine and all points west. And there was little hope of a new independent Jewish state. And this is where we're left with. So have a great rest of the evening. Next week, Dr. Loffer will be here, and he'll be talking about the life and ministry of Jesus. We'll be talking about the life and ministry of Jesus. So, and then after that, we'll be off for Thanksgiving, and then we'll come back the final week, first week of December, and we'll talk about the emergence of the early church and its context in there. So have a great rest of the evening.